broadcasting from the campus of Salisbury University. This is WSDL Ocean City 90.7 FM, Delmarva Public Radio. It's time now for a special writer's edition of Delmarva Today with host Harold Wilson.
Let them not say, we did not see it. We saw. Let them not say, we did not hear it. We heard. Let them not say, they did not taste it. We ate. We trembled. Let them not say, it was not spoken, not written. We spoke. We witnessed with voices and hands. Let them not say they did nothing. We did not enough. Let them say, as they must say something. A kerosene beauty, it burned. Let them say we warmed ourselves by it, read by its light, praised. And it burned. Jane Hirschfield, Let Them Not Say. Written in 1953. Read at the Women's March, January 21, 2017. Welcome to Delmarva Today, Writer's Edition. I'm your host, Harold Wilson. We're continuing our discussion of politics and literature today with a focus on literature and the other in authoritarian societies. My guests are Don Rush, news director for Delmarva Public Radio, Dr. Adam Wood, department chair and associate professor of English at Salisbury University, Dr. James King, Associate Professor of English at Salisbury University, and Dr. Lee Slater, Senior Lecturer of World Cultural Studies at Old Dominion University in Norfolk, Virginia. In the spirit of full disclosure, I have to tell you that Dr. Slater is my daughter. Welcome all of you to Delmarva Today, Writer's Edition.
Thank you
very much for having us.
Don, let me begin with you. What are the characteristics of an authoritarian society? We're talking about literature and authoritarian governments today. What are the characteristics of this authoritarian government?
Well, you got two really sort of mainstreams that certainly appear in the 20th century, which is authoritarianism as opposed to totalitarianism. Authoritarianism tends to be single, perhaps with one individual, perhaps as well as his family, and the emphasis is on status quo. They don't try necessarily to transform society at large. Rather, they manipulate the various classes that are there. They find, for instance, allies in the upper crust in order to, for instance, control the country for their own personal benefits. In the 20th century, we saw, for instance, Ferdinand Marcos, who was a dictator of the Philippines. And one of the things that happened was that he was able to control the Philippines for many, many years. But then there was a disaffection, particularly with the aristocratic and the upper classes. They joined with the various people and peasants below to basically overthrow him. You saw a similar event, for instance, occur in Nicaragua with the Somoza regime. Again, a family, they controlled it. And it's almost as if they had overreached in terms of their control and their greed that then produced this backlash. Again, for instance, in the case of Nicaragua, the fascinating thing was that, for instance, the people who owned La Prensa, which was the opposition newspaper during the Sandinista period that followed, they had actually joined in overthrowing Somoza to begin with and actually had joined in this process. So it's not a complete control of society, as opposed to totalitarian governments, which are quite different in many ways, even though they've been described as an extreme form of authoritarianism. Totalitarianism tries to basically take complete control of society, not through a set of classes, but through, generally speaking, ideology and perhaps a charismatic figure. We have, for instance, Stalin, of course, in the Soviet Union, Hitler certainly in Germany as well. And they don't just simply accept the way things are and simply gain, say, the profit or the power for themselves, but rather they try to transform society as a whole. In the case of the Soviet Union, for instance, we have this idea of the new Soviet man, in which they try to literally change everybody's values into what they consider to be communist values. And this extended certainly beyond Stalin in an institutional form, but nonetheless, this is the way they try to do it. And the thing about that means that, particularly for literature and for art, it all becomes subservient to the government itself. As opposed to, say, for instance, in an authoritarian government where you may have lots of art, authoritarian governments will go after those people, for instance, who challenge them. But in general, they're not really interested in trying to transform or persuade or influence people in any kind of general way. Totalitarian governments, on the other hand, are this unique breed which may have disappeared. We'll see. I mean, we still see, for instance, North Korea as an example. Even Cuba, for example, as opposed to, say, what we saw, for instance, the Sandinistas in Nicaragua, where they were much more pluralistic. So that's kind of the difference between these two, and that's how they kind of relate in terms of both literature and art. Again, you can be an artist, you can write, do all kinds of things in an authoritarian government, but if you challenge it, of course, then, of course, they try to punish you, unlike, for instance, art and literature as a function of the state itself.
Well, we tend to think of three branches of government, the executive and then the judicial and the legislative. What role in an authoritarian or even a totalitarian society do these other two branches play, and how are they managed, say?
Well, in both instances, they are subservient to the executive branch. That's really the key. And if you think about it, there's only one branch that can carry out anything, which is the executive branch, and it's bureaucracy. And then everything else is subservient to it. So that, for instance, you have a dictatorship, say, for instance, they will, decide to appoint whoever the judges are. They can oftentimes remove them. Oftentimes, dictatorships will utilize parties or mass organizations, for instance, to create a parliament or a legislature that's, say, friendly to them. In the totalitarian side of things, it's all-consuming. I mean, whether it's the party or the organization, it's all-consuming. All of those branches of government are subservient to this hierarchy that exists to serve, as it were, the whatever particular ideology that they are promoting.
Jane Hirschfield's poem that I began the program with is not the easiest poem I found anyway to understand, and I'm wondering here if Don, there's something there's something enticing about authoritarianism. There's something attractive to society about a kind of being relieved of the pressures of having to decide and so forth. What do you think Jane Hirschfield is saying in this poem? Now, I have my idea, and I will express that. But in terms of this is clearly a protest poem, and is looking at something that she's protesting. What do you think is going on in this poem? And let me read it just for our audience through one more time, so that it's short enough for that. And keep in mind an authoritarian kind of government. Let them not say we did not see it, we saw. Let them not say we did not hear it, we heard. Let them not say they did not taste it. We ate, we trembled. Let them not say it was not spoken, not written. We spoke, we witnessed with voices and hands. Let them not say they did nothing. We did not enough. Let them say, as they must say, something. A kerosene beauty. It burned. Let them say we warmed ourselves by it. Read by its light. Praised. And it burned. Now, why would she be invited to read this poem at a protest march?
I don't know who you're asking specifically, but I mean, I think in some ways to connect this back to sort of notions of authoritarian and totalitarian governments is that those forms of power don't come into power in a vacuum or in isolation, that they are typically held up by large numbers of people. It is easy to sort of pin the blame on Hitler, sort of an obvious example, but everybody, you know, wants to forget that Hitler was elected when he first came to power. And so that there is, I think, what is almost more dangerous than a sort of authoritarian or totalitarian figure are the individuals who allow it to occur, right? Who sort of sit idly by and sort of allow that sort of atrocity to go on. Because, again, I think it's one of these things where people often don't realize they're in the midst of totalitarianism until it's too late, right? When they sort of sat by and just let these things happen. And so in some ways, I wonder if the poem is sort of a call to arms against sort of a complicity or an apathy at the rise of those sort of strong figured politics that, you know, a lot of people are concerned that we're starting to see in this country.
So let them say we warmed ourselves by it, read by it, praised, and it burned. Is that an acquiescence? Is that what she's saying to us?
I mean, I think there's that, but I think there's also a sense of, you know, the authoritarian figure, the totalitarian figure, the tyrant gives us something in return for our complicity, right? Gives us a sense of comfort, right? Gives us something that we can blame for our problems, right? Again, if we go back to the example of Hitler, the Jews were sort of offered up as, well, here's the problem, right? So I can save you from that. And then when the Jews weren't enough, it was the gypsies and homosexuals. And so, you know, it is, you know, you find sort of what people fear and you feed them that fear. And in response to that, I think that's how we see the rise of dictators, right? And again, you know, any number of places we find different versions to sort of connect to the title of the program. But, you know, a dictator, a totalitarian government always requires some other that it is protecting us from, right? Again, for Hitler, it was largely the Jews and a number of other groups. But in even current situations, you know, we see the alt-right really putting forward this sort of the fear of the Muslim, the fear of the immigrant, right? And those are simply the new others. They're not new, but the others that are sort of being used in this way. And it feeds into sort of a pre-existing fear in a sadly large portion of the population. And so that there is, in that sort of sense, there are always, unfortunately, large groups of individuals who will celebrate the rise of those sort of strong figures.
I would like to add that potentially the end of this poem suggests a kind of rebellion, because while we can find indifference to be one of the greatest evils in the world, you know, not acting, not speaking out, looking the other way. Elie Wiesel said the opposite of love is not hate, but indifference. Mm-hmm. The opposite of life is not death, but indifference to life or death.
And Camus' comments about rebelling against the silence.
Right. So I think that when Jane Hirschfield is saying, let them say we warmed ourselves by it, read by its light, praised, and it burned, is maybe suggesting that there is room here for resistance, revolt, rebellion, in a way that fills that official, that struggles against the official language, which is what they, in an authoritarian or totalitarian governmental structure, would be in control of, right? That's the main tool, is controlling language. If you control language, you control thought. And so here, it's sort of subverting that official language by offering a space, a quiet space, but a powerful space for revolt.
And I think you're right. I mean, that shift from the they to the we, right, is that sort of key thing, that there were those who allowed this to happen. We have to sort of respond to that in that sort of way. And again, I mean, I think we're seeing this in American culture now. I mean, I think it's not surprising that with the rise of the sort of alt-right or neo-Nazi or fascist sort of sense of things, that we're seeing an equally, if not larger, establishment of the alt-left, right, or the sort of anti-fascist movement. Perhaps not always in the best approaches in terms of engaging with violence that directly, but there is that sort of sense that, totalitarian governments or any sort of figures always are resisted in some ways, and that resistance is always there. It's a question of what can it do? What power can it seize in its resistance?
Well, we're talking about resistance with poetry, with the arts, and I it struck me that the budget that was recently offered eliminated funding for the National Endowment for the Arts. It eliminated funding for the National Endowment for Humanities. It eliminated funding for the Institute of Museums and Library Sciences, and also, closer to home, the Corporation for Public Broadcasting as well. Why do authoritarian governments tend to attack first the arts? Why are authoritarian governments afraid of the arts? What do the arts, and particularly for our discussion, poetry and literature, what do they offer that that causes these governments to want to eliminate them? And from what Don mentioned, we could probably go down through all of those dictators and find that the arts were among the first things that they attacked.
I think part of the reason,
James,
part of the reason that the arts become sort of the first group that are attacked is because, as you were speaking, I was thinking of a phrase or something that my English teacher back in high school told me a long time ago. She said, "I don't want to be the most powerful leader in the world. I don't want to be the richest person in the world. If I want to really be an influential, let me be the person that writes the lyrics to the popular songs." And so you see totalitarian governments and autocratic regimes attempting to silence those voices because they present and offer the greatest possibility for the other's voice to be heard. They offer the greatest chance and greatest possibility for those marginalized, those not a part of that particular regime, to have a voice. That's why there are so many important radio shows. I think about some of the shows that I came to understand to exist during the course of the Vietnam War and beyond, that provided access and provided information about what was not the most popular war that we were involved in. The arts has the responsibility of standing up against power, of speaking truth to power at every occasion when that power is not offering itself to communities, to constituencies, in a way that's going to serve all the people. You think of the killing fields in I believe it was Laos. Some of the first individuals to make it to make that list were the educators, were the folks that were involved in trying to enlighten and broaden the scope of individuals' perspectives on the world. And so, by definition, a totalitarian regime would be anathema to that and would attempt to try to silence anything that's attempting to give voice in that way.
I think art and literature are the home for a kind of bearing witness to lived experience. And so if we silence those experiences, then if one doesn't have the opportunity to share that lived experience, then we have a breakdown in community and the loss of voices of those who, like James is saying, are potentially who are marginalized. You know, as Don was talking earlier, I kept thinking of China during the Cultural Revolution as, you know, one of those great examples. But it was a silencing in terms of censorship. But it was also this revolution of culture, so that all artistic and literary production had to glorify the ideology of the state. So Mao said that art and literature should be a mirror of Chinese society. So this is from 1966 to 1976. And a lot of artists and writers at the time were very quietly, subversively, in underground ways, like changing the license plates on their bicycles when they would meet, in order to write together, would challenge that idea by saying, well, Mao is trying to create art and literature as a mirror of not society as it actually exists, but as how it should be in his image of a perfect Chinese society. And so writers like, there's a poet whose name is Bei Dao. He would meet with his buddies and they wrote in this way, it was called misty poetry, where they wrote this poetry that on the surface read as if it was partaking, you know, it was respecting this kind of dictate by Mao, but it was actually subverting it by using coded language that was influencing others in order to share their lived experiences through this coded or misty poetry. And so I think that in that way, you've got really this value in shared experience, even in one of the most totalitarian governmental structures that we've seen in the 20th century.
Yeah, I think to sort of add to that, that there's sort of at least two different ways to sort of think about it. One is the sort of the more subtle sort of art that has to sort of fly under the radar in terms of getting its message across, right? It has to be sort of sneaky in some ways, has to sort of embed those messages in a way that the art sort of exposes the workings of the ideology of a tyrannical government. The flip side, that there's a sort of a stronger version, I think of Franz Fanon's sort of notion of the literature of combat or combat literature, right? The sort of notion that there are literary texts that can be so overwhelmingly powerful that they become quite literally a call to arms. We can think about this in the way he was talking about it, was sort of in the colonial or resistance to colonialism. But you think of when James mentioned rock and roll, it came to my mind thinking of the old punk rock band The Clash in the sort of early 1980s, sort of very conservative British policies, and their sort of notion of combat rock, right? That pop songs could somehow actually become vehicles for some sort of revolution, right? Calling for people to go out into the streets. So I guess less than a difference is sort of a question of scale of these kind of things. But I think it really is, it does go down in that sense that art is an expression of the culture that can set itself against the ideological dictates of strong-arm governments. Strong-arm governments do function somewhat by violence, but predominantly by ideology, right? When violence kicks in, you're not doing your job right in a sort of authoritarian society. And so the notion of is that to sort of keep the ideology of the other, again, very firmly in place, and to see art that emerges sort of out of that to construct a counter-ideology in some ways is a very powerful thing.
You were asking earlier, you know, to what extent does art and literature really impact change in society? And so just to build on what you're saying, when you think about French colonialism and you think about Léopold Sédar Senghor from Senegal or Aimé Césaire from Guadeloupe, who were poets and writers who took back language in order to give the Martinican and Guadeloupean peoples and the Senegalese people their identity back through language by incorporating Creole or Mandeng, Paul Serrer, any of those languages from Senegal, but who then became actual statesmen, who then were the architects of their society's independence from the colonial structure of France. And France is known for policing its language around the world. Still today impose certain amount of fines if certain quotas on the radio of, you know, the songs that are played aren't originally French songs. So I think, you know, in terms of instituting actual tangible change that we see on a global scale, those guys are really emblematic of the literary artist turning statesman as a voice for those people.
I think you're right.
negritude, the concept of negritude that emanates from Cesare and from Senghor, is that resistance in action. It is that resistance personified. I was thinking of West African nations like Nigeria and Ghana, and the struggle that they've gone through in terms of trying to establish themselves as sovereign spaces. And with, for instance, with Ghana, with Ghana's first president, Kwame Nkrumah, he started as the sort of prototypical grassroots politician, sort of got his chops here in the United States, went back to Ghana, and became Ghana's first PM in 57, first president in 1960. But by 1966, right before the coup that took him out of office, there were these disturbing reports of Nkrumahism, a concept that sort of evolved around his personality, and his quest for an African personality became the primary. And while working over there, I had the occasion to teach with faculty that as young people grew up during that period, right before Nkrumah was removed as president, and they talked about the fact that the Young Pioneers was a children's organization that was a part of Nkrumah's regime. And if you, for instance, if a parent would not allow their child to go to a Young Pioneers meeting, there was not necessarily any punishment for the child, but mother and father might be sent to a re-education camp. So literature, the arts can also sort of be, it's a double-edged sword. It's a multiple faceted sword in terms of how it can be used to import and to confirm totalitarian ideology, or used as a bulwark against it.
Lee, you did some work in Rwanda, I know, and you worked with some of the poets over there, and also a stage group that you worked with. Tell us a little bit about the poets, and what are they working on, and this the stage group, which is actually a humor group as well.
So I've been very lucky to travel and work in Rwanda for the past 7 years, approximately once a year, and Rwanda, as most people know, is post-genocide. Genocide in Rwanda occurred in 1994 in April, and what we're seeing in Rwanda today is this amazing explosion of cultural expression that takes many forms, but the forms that I've been participating in happen to be the stand-up poetry, spoken word artists, stand-up poetry, open mic nights. And because I was able to work with those folks, and over the years I've gotten to know them more and more, and so I'm attending their events and seeing how their work is growing and how it's becoming shared, also with as they participate more and more with literary groups from neighboring countries as well. And so now they have visiting poets coming in, and they're doing workshops and all these amazing things. But what I've seen grow out of that is a comedy troupe called Comedy Nights. And so when you say, Rwanda and comedy in the same sentence, people sort of step back and be like, I don't know. But these are young men and women who are in their late 20s now, and whose families experienced, like everyone did in Rwanda, the genocide. And they're using art and literature as a way to come to terms with their own lived everyday experiences. And as a young generation who's creating, creating their own cultural identity, who are moving beyond sort of the former differences that were established initially because of colonization. So moving beyond markers like Hutu and Tutsi and Twa, and who are seeing themselves as Rwandan. So they're able to, many of them have, for example, families who were exiled into neighboring countries like Burundi. And so those folks have French as a native language. Others who were in other English-speaking countries like Kenya have English. And so these young folks are all coming together, and they're creating their works of literature in multiple linguistic spaces at the same time. And so you'll hear one poem that's got Kinyarwanda and English and French interwoven, and everyone in the group hearing at these spoken word performances are nodding along, laughing at these inside jokes, and you see this sort of shared Rwandan identity that doesn't negate anybody's past lived experience. So it's really this amazing thing to be a part of and to see, and the comedians are able to play in those spaces brilliantly. And so they, in the beginning, they had to, on the posters, for example, that I saw around Kigali, there was a line at the bottom of the poster that said, you know, comedy nights performing Friday night at the Serena Hotel. And then at the bottom of the poster, it's okay to laugh. So the idea was training an entire population that it's okay to express oneself creatively, and it's okay to joke, and it's okay to receive that in a way that's relaxed and laugh along. And so the interplay of identity and also cohesiveness within a community in this younger generation is just wonderful.
You all talked about reclaiming a language, and to some degree, not necessarily reclaiming a culture, but creating a culture out of this language. And it also sounds to me like reclaiming a self and re-identifying a self. And when we started at the top of our broadcast, I mentioned that we wanted to talk about a focus on literature and the other. Adam, what, and you as well, Don, what do we mean when we talk about the other? Is this some kind of technical literary critique language that we need to be afraid of, or what is this term, the other, that we mentioned?
I mean, it is a term that has really emerged a lot in literary studies, but I don't think that it is just unique to that. I mean, in some ways, it's in the simplest terms, it is the other of the dominant group, right? So whichever the dominant group is, the individuals who are not in that dominant group are the other. But at the same time, the idea of the image of the other is something that is always created by the dominant group. It is created as the opposite of the sort of the binary relation of the dominant group. And so if the dominant group is smart, the other has to be uneducated or unintelligent. If the dominant group is civilized, the other must be savage, right? And so we think about how the dominant group requires the other to define themselves in that sort of sense. And in that process must also, again, we come back to sort of notions of authoritarian governments or totalitarian governments, must silence that voice of the other, right? And that other's language, that other's culture, even if it is a shared language, right? Sort of how we use language is very often sort of limited to the ways that we can speak. And so when we think about the other and those uses of language, it can either be in a reclaiming of a silenced language or a redefining of the dominant language. There's a French literary theorist by the name of Gilles Deleuze who talks about sort of a deterritorialization of language. It's sort of a 25-cent word in some ways. But the idea of taking the language of the dominant culture, the dominant group, and subverting it against itself, right? Redefining certain terms. In American culture, we can think of a number of terms that have sort of happened that way. You know, the first one sort of pops in my head is the idea of gay and lesbian groups sort of reclaiming the term queer, right? Which had become sort of this hostile term, but then sort of is re-territorialized, to go back to that sense, and given sort of a more positive, hopeful, and even playful. I mean, to go back to this idea of comedy, that there was a play in it, that it was, I always think of a great line from The Simpsons where the gay film director John Waters is on and Homer Homer Simpson, when he's confronted with the word queer, he says, but that's our word for making fun of you. And so you can see the sort of conflict of even those subversive little shifts in language can become these very powerful sort of political gestures in a lot of ways, I think.
You get a lot of that taking place through the period of the American Reconstruction period and onward, with regard to the sort of flowering of African American literature, literature written in English, spoken in English, read, understood in English, English being the language, the language form of the oppressor. Houston Baker, literary scholar, talks about a phenomenon he calls the mastery of form and the deformation of mastery as relates to literature. Mastery of form speaks to individuals who are that Edward Saidian term other, who are identified as the other, but who have shown themselves capable of mastering the forms of literature created by, put forward by their oppressors. Good example of that would be Paul Laurence Dunbar or County Cullen, and the ability to write the Elizabethan sonnet, perhaps as good or better than they were writing in the 1600s. And then the alternative to that is deformation of mastery, where you have mastered a literary form, and now you turn that form to your own purposes, use it for your own subversive, perhaps, your own sort of under-the-radar intents. And a good example of that during the same period would be Charles Chestnut, taking the subgenre of plantation fiction, which by definition was intended to caricature and to hold up for ridicule the African American subject. Chestnut takes that form, shows his mastery of it, and then takes it a step further and engages a ludic component, a comical component to it, that creates the inside joke that only those on the inside get. And within Chestnut's fiction, the other become the insiders, mm-hmm. and the dominant culture become the outsiders.
Yeah, I think in particular when we look at the United States today, we're moving towards what's considered to be a multicultural society, mm-hmm. much more present. Often remind people that when Ronald Reagan was elected in 1980, 85% of the electorate was white. Now it's down to about 70%. We suspect that they will continue to shift and change. And I think one of the things that will happen, and I think one of the things that's happening, I think, in American culture, is that we are now seeing the expression of whole groups of people who have been excluded for years in one fashion or another. So we get arguments about safe zones, we get arguments about political correctness, and so on and so forth. And when I look at those arguments, if I stand back, what I think I'm looking at is a society that's trying to come to grips with these kinds of changes that they never had to do before. You know, if you could walk around and never, particularly someone who's white, and never encounter anything beyond one's own sphere of friends and so on. Now we're bombarded not only by people that we meet, but also by figures, for instance, in the media, television, newspapers, books, so on and so forth. We're now bombarded. I'm thinking of particularly, for instance, when you're talking about the gay and lesbian folks, imagine how dramatic the change has been in terms of public support for gay marriage. I mean, only 10 years ago, it didn't, you know, it was a minority kind of opinion. But because of this shift and change in terms of the exposure of people to this particular group of people, we're now seeing greater and greater acceptance. And I think we're seeing a society that's trying to come to grips with all of these various groups that until now had been sort of hidden away. And I think that's sort of an exciting thing to happen within over the next 50 years. I mean, I think it's going to be really fascinating. But I think it's one of the things we're seeing in American culture. And I think that's so that you get all these various people who come for, whether it's actors, or whether it's writers, that kind of thing. You're now beginning to see that come to fore. So I see a sort of an interesting mix when you talk about the other. Well, who is the other eventually in 50 years?
Well, I always thought of the other in the colonizing period, because when countries were colonized, you had to have another culture in order to suppress, in order for economic and other reasons. We've hit on it a little bit. Don just did. Who are the others in our society today? Who are, and I'm thinking in a colonizing kind of way. I keep coming up with the word colonial, but that has other meanings for us. But in a colonizing way, who are the others in our society? And the other word I kind of ran into with other was another strange word, othering. And I guess that's the process of subordinating another group of people is the othering process. Am I right on this? And does the sense today of this concept of othering fit what is going on in our society today?
One of the questions would be raised, and I steal this from somebody's book, is we look at, for instance, the community of Ferguson, African American, dominated by this sort of white police force. Is that a colony? Is that and all these various small, you know, groups of neighborhoods, and which are dramatically different, whether it's treated by law enforcement or whether they get benefits of society or what have you. Are those now the other in our own society?
Yeah, I mean, I think one of the tough things we think about the colonial, you know, enterprise in some ways is always ostensibly or ideologically grounded in saving these others. Oh, these poor, whatever group it is, these poor savages, whatever, that they need to be saved. And so when you have that, if you think about the colonial enterprise, as it moved into Africa or India, that it was always grounded in sort of bringing the light to these places, right? Sort of shedding, bringing the savages up to civilization. And so there's always that sort of language of it. But in that, there is, again, the dominant group or the strongest group, we think militarily, imposes a definition of that other on themselves, and that that colonized group is having to work sort of under those kind of notions. I mean, think about Ferguson in some ways. Do we still have a notion in America that white culture is somehow saving black culture, right? That yes, we think, there are individuals who look at places like Ferguson and very easily play into sort of classic sort of racist notions of, oh, well, this is why we need strong white police there to keep these sorts of things from happening. And so, I mean, the question of sort of who the other is in America is, it's a growing group or set of groups, I think. And the question is, sort of how do we respond? I mean, I think it's unfortunate anytime you watch the CNN and they'll have, or CNN or any of the number of channels, and they'll be having a discussion, for example, about the issue of Muslims in America, and it's five white guys sitting around having a conversation. Rarely are Muslims involved in those conversations, which, on the one hand, seems to be a notion of openness, but very often simply re-others the other, simply reinforces that process in a gentler, sort of way, theoretically.
And the irony of the current moment is that if my research is not incorrect, the fastest growing religion, I don't know if it's in the U.S. or everywhere, is Islam. Mm-hmm. And to your question of what is the other, who is the other, I think the other is quickly becoming white America. And that's part of the reason that we see the pushback that we do against marginalized communities coming to the fore. That's why we see the sort of active and very orchestrated, well-thought-out resistance to marginalized communities trying to make their voices heard. When I hear white constituents, saying with heartfelt emotion, "We just want our country back," that's a hearkening. It's an atavistic hearkening for a period of American history that I'm not particularly interested in going back to. I think that some of what we're seeing in terms of current political trends on both sides of any sort of a left or a right spectrum is a reaction to the changing demographics of the American population, to the changing, to the reality that in some parts of the country, English is not the L1 anymore, for good or ill. And that's, a topic for another discussion. But what I see in the xenophobia that seems to be presenting itself in our current moment is sort of a last-ditch attempt to capture, retain, preserve a thing that, by my account, really wasn't a thing really ever to begin with. But others becoming a very slippery word. It's gone from those marginalized that were a minority, and now since the minority are becoming the majority, the dominant culture, in my opinion, is at risk of, or is responding in a way that reflects anxiety about them, they themselves being othered.
Do you think that there is such a thing as American culture?
It's funny. When I was in Africa, when I was talking to Ghanaians, they would say, well, you need to distinguish whether or not you're talking about someone who is Bronga Hafo or Ga or a, Khan's Bronga Hafo, but by different clans or tribes. And then if you are outside of Ghana, but still in Africa, you refer to yourself as a Ghanaian. If you're outside of Africa altogether, you refer to yourself as African. So it seems to be contingent upon where you are at a particular moment.
I think that, first of all, just I have to say, this reminds me, I really enjoy teaching Saul Williams, mm-hmm. and Saul Williams' spoken word poetry is phenomenal. And he lived in Paris for a long time, and he went to Senegal, and I've seen this video clip of him that I like to show my classes where he says, woo, after going to Senegal, sometimes he thinks of himself more as American-African than African-American. Saul Williams is just fantastic, if your listeners would like to investigate his work. But going back to what you were saying earlier, and to what we talked about a little while ago, which is language and the power of language, I think, unfortunately, we're seeing the power of language manipulated in this soundbite world, right? It's fueling hatred, divisions in society, and so really the antidote has to be art and literature as a space for a multitude of voices, as a space for empathy and understanding, and a welcoming of a pluralistic discourse in American society. So I also think of Chimamanda Adichie's great TED Talk called The Danger of the Single Story, mm-hmm. where she's a Nigerian writer, and she talks about how, I'll just give the example of Rwanda. When you think of Rwanda, the first thing that comes to mind is genocide. And so what this young generation of Rwandan writers and poets are doing is they're trying to break away from that. It's not negate this history, but in the process of coming to terms with this recent history, also come to terms with who they are and what they want to be on a world stage. And so to kind of separate themselves a little bit from that one blanket term, genocide, which the rest of the world associates with them. And Chimamanda Adichie went to college in the United States, and she said that she too, when she came here, realized that she had, by default, these single stories of what Americans are, who Americans are, Mexicans, as she said, she had this false idea of Mexicans as grouped together as abject immigrants. And she had to struggle against those single stories, those single ideas that she had, and that are, of course, perpetuated by language in the news and on television, and to really fight that pervasive control of limiting language, and open her mind to the possibilities of the complexities of people around her. And so she advocates for struggling against the single story, always sort of check ourselves. Is this the only story? There must be something more. And I think that literature offers really that space for that multitude of opinions and perspectives.
I mean, I would definitely agree with that. I mean, I think that there's a sense where art, literature, allows for the possibility of an infinite number of voices sort of expressing their own narratives, their own stories. And so when we think, you know, is there an idea of American culture, right, to sort of go to that, it's certainly not what it used to be, again, to go to what James is sort of saying, and I think that's a great thing. But I think, you know, perhaps we're in sort of a moment of certain growing pains where we can't figure out what American culture is before we figure out what the cultures of different people in Americas are, right? Just think about those sort of multiple expressions. You know, the whole notion of Make America Great Again is based on sort of nostalgia for a past that never was. You know, I remember sort of Dan Quayle years and years ago talking about sort of getting back to the life of Leave It to Beaver and those sorts of things. And, you know, when you watch Leave It to Beaver, there's some strange absences in the world in Leave It to Beaver. You know, and so, I mean, nostalgia is always that sort of thing. But what is, I think the difficult thing is to hear or to encounter an expression from a culture that is radically different from your own. And to be open to that in such a way. And only once we sort of have all of those sort of stories, those narratives on the table, at that point, you know, can we then begin to move forward and say, how are things shared between these cultures? But all those voices, those expressions have not come out yet. So it's, I think it's impossible to conceptualize a monolithic sort of notion of American culture.
Well, I wonder whether or not there aren't underlying sort of connections. That is, that on the one hand, we see certainly lots of differences, whether it's at the barbershop or it's the food you eat or whatever it happens to be, right? That's one set of differences. But that underlying that is an American culture, and we're talking about high quality, talk about, you know, basic governments, everybody loves baseball, this kind of thing. One of the things that comes to my mind is how different many ways, for instance, talking about the Muslim community. Muslim community in the United States is actually very much different than, say, for instance, the Muslim community in Europe. And part of the reason is because in Europe, there seems to be cut off, both intentionally from the outside and the inside. In the United States, Muslim community has become acclimatized to all the values and all the things that we now think about, for instance, in terms of democracy and so on and so forth, and that even our tastes, even though we might go out to different restaurants. So I think in some ways there is this underlying culture that exists, and that whatever culture you're in, and you absorb that, so that you absorb the basics. So, for instance, I don't see, for instance, we talk about the Hispanic community. Generally, by the second generation, the generation that's born here, they can speak both probably Spanish and English. But there's no doubt they can speak English. By the third, of course, now sometimes they don't even speak Spanish anymore. So there's this tremendous culturalization that takes place. In addition to the fact that immigrants who do come here, who don't speak English, who speak Spanish, they flood these English learning classes. So they want to become American. I'm often reminded, for instance, of the Japanese during the 1930s and 40s. Where you could see photographs of them, and they're all dressed in these ties and the suits and so on, very classically Western. They're not wearing what people were wearing in Japan. So I think there's these underlying values, I think, that the United States has, and may make it unique. I don't know.
That's true, but we did also round the Japanese out.
Well, that's true, too.
Internment camps, and so even, you know, for the...
didn't help them too
much. Yeah,
right.
Yeah, I was going to say, you know,
exactly. But there is that underlying culture that exists, and so we emerge. I mean, if I think about the progress that's been made in terms of recognition of all these various people, you know, we have a long way to go, there's no doubt about it, but there is an underlying culture that seems to be pushing us forward into acceptance of others. I mean, in some ways, and I think about like the Europeans, for example. Europeans, I think, are going to have a difficult time, for instance, dealing with immigration just because they tend to be homogeneous. We, on the other hand, are full of all kinds of different people and are constantly churning all the time.
Nevertheless, the numbers of people being deported from the United States are
quite
phenomenally high after this new administration had come in. And while 3 of 5 are individuals who are understood to have had a criminal record, the preponderance of the people, according to a Washington Post article I read not long ago, that are being deported are not criminals. They're not those bad hombres.
I think, James, you raised a really very good point in this. And let me suggest that perhaps one of the things relative to the other that is happening today is that the dominant class, for the first time, feels a real threat. And that threat is getting played out by the othering that is currently going on. And by othering in this sense, I mean the identification of these other groups of people. And it doesn't matter what language they speak or that, Don, they've adopted the kind of base culture down here and wear suits and ties and so forth. That, to some degree, doesn't matter because they are identified now by a religion. They are identified by characteristics, physical characteristics are identified in other ways. So let me ask, does creating and maintaining an autocratic or an authoritarian society require the subordination of the other? Is it in order to be a dominant government, do you have to subordinate? And so then you can identify yourself by not being the other.
I think that any controlling authoritarian society has to engineer compliance within the population. And so when you think about how one would engineer compliance, control of language, control of movement of populations, whether it's, you know, deportations of
mass incarceration.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Mass incarceration. So there are so many ways that one engineers compliance, but I think that the word you're using is enforcing subordination. The word I'm using is kind of forcing a compliance, but I think that that's how it works. There's nothing more basic than self versus other, right? But when one establishes superiority and then institutionalizes superiority by this kind of engineering of compliance is where we run into lots of trouble. When we stop listening to other perspectives, when we only think of American literature as Hemingway, Faulkner, you know, Steinbeck, and we don't consider the works of Edwige Dantica or you know, many of the other writers who are immigrants and who have settled in the United States, Isabel Allende in California and Texas, and Chitra Divakaruni, for example, an Indian American author. When we're not listening to those voices, when they don't have value, is also when we run into a kind of forced compliance.
And initiatives that would attempt to squelch or to limit funding for the arts has to be viewed with a certain degree of alarm and scrutiny during our present moment, when we see a direct correlation between othered or marginalized societies. There is a suicide rate among gay, lesbian, transgender teenagers in the United States for a brief moment dropped. But now there is a risk of those rates sort of returning to their otherwise alarming level as restrictions related to LGBT communities are gaining traction in regards to their being reinstituted, reversals of the previous administration's practices. And something that really stuck out to me was the marked and immediate drop in suicides among folks within those communities, because the cultural climate that was afforded them acknowledged their existence, respected their existence, as opposed to something that does something else, more nefarious.
That's why we have a struggle. It's not a straight line.
Yeah.
It's not a straight line.
I would suggest that, again, based on your comments earlier, James, that part of the struggle going on is for the dominant group to identify itself. and to come to terms with who it is. And currently, Don, we're talking about the struggle that you just mentioned. My sense is, who is writing this literature today? Who is defining this world? And that is going to be the subject of our discussion next month. We will talk about dystopian literature. Now, there's another 25 cent, and we will define
That's
it.
Right.
We will define it and explore it in the next program. What we've seen is that it's impossible to talk about the other without talking about the self. And I'd like to end with a poem by Langston Hughes entitled, I Too. I too sing, America. I am the darker brother. They send me to eat in the kitchen when company comes, but I laugh and eat well and grow strong. Tomorrow, I'll be at the table when company comes. Nobody'll dare say to me, eat in the kitchen then. Besides, they'll see how beautiful I am and be ashamed. I, too, am America. Don, Adam, James, Lee, thank you very much for this wonderful discussion today. And thank you all for listening to Delmarva Today, Writer's Edition. I'm your host, Harold Wilson.
You've been listening to a special writer's edition of Delmarva Today with their host, Harold Wilson. This program is produced on the campus of Salisbury University for Delmarva Public Radio. Christopher Rank is your audio engineer. Mary Seaman is the volunteer producer. Visit our website, delmarvapublicradio.net, for podcasts of this program.